Welcome to Open Minds. It's the podcast that attempts to explore with genuine curiosity the world's most intriguing issues. Some topics include climate change, gun control, basic income, and so much more. I invite guests on who are both proponents and detractors of these issues so that we can be exposed to more nuanced perspectives we may not be hearing. You can find me at openmindspodcast.com or anywhere you stream music. I'm your host, Christopher Balkrin, and welcome to Open Minds. Happy New Year, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that new podcast intro. It's just a small step in where I want to take the podcast into 2023. As you know, I've done an entire series on gun violence, and I've reached out to community activists, organizations, and prominent names. But one voice that has been left out has been the City of Toronto and their response to gun violence. I invited Scott McKean on, manager of the City of Toronto's response called SafeTO, to talk explicitly about what the City of Toronto is doing to respond to gun violence. You can find this episode anywhere you stream music, as well as on my new website called openmindspodcast.com. I hope you enjoy this one. Scott, thank you so much for joining me here on the Open Minds podcast. I decided to reach out to you because you come highly recommended from Louis March. And I want to discuss specifically what the City of Toronto is doing in response to gun violence.
Thanks so much for having me here, Christopher. It's really an honor to speak with you today. The city's SafeTO community safety and well-being plan was adopted by council. It was adopted because, you know, number one, it was necessary. With the plan, what we're actually trying to do is shift how we think about safety by factoring in the well-being of people. Historically in our city, you know, the concept of safety has been about crime or policing, you know, or over-policing or the combination of crime and policing. And really, a lot of the root issues that we need and ought to be addressing had been forgotten. And so we're actually trying to take a bold step to be a little more preventative in how we think about safety and think about the full scope of what it actually means to, you know, foster well-being in communities, you know, as a mechanism to creating safer city. Several academics, several community partners, parents, moms, dads reached out to us over the years, you know, in ways that we can improve the city. And we listened to them. And throughout the development of SafeTO, we consulted a number of groups that sort of led us to where we're going. Really, if there was a couple of consistent themes, one is that we need to be more proactive and preventative systematically as a city. We also need to look at communities that are disproportionately impacted by community safety and well-being issues in our city. And we need to build with community, you know, and we need to build this with the stakeholders who are most impacted and really bring everybody to the table. And so there was lots of ways that we were doing that as a city. SafeTO provides a new direction for us to really be intentional about how we're going to advance this.
You mentioned root causes, and I wanted to know more about what was done perhaps before SafeTO and what SafeTO seems to address in the gaps in addressing some of those root causes.
The best way for me to answer that is to really tell you a little bit about SafeTO and how we're aiming to address some of these issues. And so SafeTO is actually consists of it's a framework that, you know, factors the scope of our resources and tools and mandates and how multiple systems come together to address community safety and well-being. And so it provides a roadmap for us to be able to do that. Additionally, what SafeTO does is it has identified 7 goals and 26 actions across those 7 goals. And goals are very high level, and then the actions sort of drill down and are a little more specific. And so the goals are reduce vulnerability, reduce violence, advance truth and reconciliation, promote healing and justice, invest in people, invest in neighborhoods, and drive collaboration and accountability. Now, while they're very high level, you know, underneath those are very intentional goals, like so to become a trauma-informed and responsive city. For us as a city to not only realize that the services, the investments, our practices and approaches need to be trauma-informed, but actually to build the capacity of ourselves and our sector to understand trauma and to really understand the specific nature in which trauma impacts people, also where the root of that trauma is coming from. And so the strategy as a whole really provides us, you know, some intentional places where we can collaborate with other system leaders and community to build collective interventions to address each one of the sort of overarching goals.
Scott, you mentioned trauma-informed policy, and that's a phrase that I've heard a few times now from people inside the city, outside the city. I wanted to know more about what that means. As I understand it, taking into account those that have experienced trauma and trying to build policy that addresses that trauma. Is that a fair understanding of that phrase?
First of all, creating an understanding of what trauma is really important in the work that we're doing. Creating a baseline with community to define what that is so we can build certain mechanisms to understand that within the service system is a starting place. But then we also need to be responsive to trauma and understand that things like adverse childhood experiences, for example, which, you know, to our early comments about root causes, can actually be a contributing factor to poor health outcomes in a community. Can be a contributing factor to increased violence in community. And the only way for us to be responsive to that is to understand the nature of that trauma. And then lastly is to understand the specific nature of that trauma. And so trauma can come through all sorts of shapes and sizes, come through exposure to violence, for example, can come through systemic racism, anti-Black racism, anti-Indigenous racism in our systems. It can come through poverty. And so it's understanding the nature of what trauma is and then how it manifests in our community. I think the last thing I would say is that, you know, as we think about, you know, I use trauma as one example, but really I was also speaking about root causes. One of the things that I think is really critical is in a city like Toronto, while the city is amazing, I love the city, worked here for a number of years, and I've lived in Toronto for most of my life. And so what I think is really critical is that as amazing as Toronto is and the growth that the city has experienced, not everybody has been able to participate in that growth in an equitable way. As a result, those inequities, especially if they're left unattended to, it creates divides in our system, in our social health, education, justice, and other political systems. And that sort of can have an impact on our disproportionate impact on specific elements of our city. If we don't address those things at the root level, that's where they manifest into safety issues. That's where you can actually see disproportionate impacts of trauma or violence or other kind of root factors. And unless we're thinking about those things as we're trying to enhance community safety and well-being, we're not going to solve the outcomes of things like violence or gun violence or other things. We really need to think holistically about the inequities, how to address them, and how to build community and spaces so that we can try to prevent the sort of issues that we want to address through safety.
As you were speaking, I was thinking about the commitment this would be long-term. So that safety is a 10-year plan. Operating in a municipality, in a government that is heavily influenced by politics and elected officials, what are some of the ways we're going to sustain that momentum in the event of a new administration that may put less priority? You know, sometimes these policies are great, but we're still at the whim of our political masters. So how does the city make sure that this is still top of mind, regardless of what happens in a few weeks and in the next election in 4 years?
Great, great question. Thanks, Christopher. I mean, the first thing, you know, my very first point this evening was really that community gave us a mandate, and they gave us a mandate to really try to advance safety and well-being and think differently in all the things that I've talked about thus far. And as part of that mandate, that allowed us to build out the SafeTO framework. However, that mandate that community has given us is in line with provincial direction. And so one of the most unique things that's happened in the province of Ontario under the Community Safety and Policing Act is that every municipality across the province was mandated or legislated to develop a community safety and well-being plan. And while that's an extra burden on municipalities who are already doing that work, it provides a unique opportunity to help drive like systemic level change and ground multiple municipalities in you know, a similar approach, which can serve as learning unto itself. The other thing that it's beneficial for is, while council committed to the direction that we're going in SafetyO for 10 years, through the legislation, we'll be sort of revitalizing or revamping this strategy every 4 years, which provides an accountability back to community and also to other levels of government. And so we have a continuum that we didn't have before, where through the legislation, we will be reporting back to council regularly, so we can update the province on how we're doing with the implementation of the community safety and well-being plan. And we have the commitment from council to do this for 10 years, you know, understanding that we'll be modifying and then to look at the outcomes and then to build off of them and see where we're going to go from there. The combination of those two things combined with the most important thing, community buy-in and community mandate, allows us to bring together other levels of government, strategic city policy, and community involvement and leadership into the same sphere. And that's the only thing that's really going to sustain this. If the community feels it's beneficial, we're actually doing something to address the issues that they've raised and that, you know, that they've given us a direction to respond to.
You know, Scott, I can, I've had Louis March, leader of the Zero Gun Violence Movement, here on the podcast before, and I could just hear him in my ear. Louis and others have mentioned a lot of data, a lot of feedback, a lot of, in many ways, reliving trauma, as we discussed, has been provided to city officials. And that in itself is a challenge for many community members, as I'm sure you're very much aware. Reliving losing a loved one, a child, and perhaps they're wondering why things are taking as long as they are in the bureaucratic machine of the city and the province, despite providing all the data again and again. Can you speak to or address how those concerns can be assuaged and let folks know that this is a much more long-term plan and that the province and the city are now kind of working in more cohesion on this issue now than perhaps ever before?
And I think it really comes down to, these are, you know, I would say these are complex issues. They are and they're not. I mean, the roots, if you take an issue like gun violence, you know, it really, you know, it really can be complex. It really shouldn't be, because gun violence is an outcome, right? Gun violence is what happens at the end of a trajectory. And well, we know that inequities are manifesting in our communities, and we know we need to build the capacity of community leadership. And that takes time. It also takes time. You know, there is a number of investments in the city that are by other levels of government that are in communities that, you know, could be better integrated. You know, if you're talking to Louis, you know, he always talks about the first word in community safety and well-being is community. So community needs to be at the heart of it. But also, both Louis and I always are caught saying the same thing at meetings, but it's like, you need everybody at the table. And unless we're going to do that, people aren't going to feel that direct change. And then the third part of it is, you know, I think that for us, communication is where we're really terrible. And we need to work with community about how do we actually communicate better about what's happening. The natural thing for us to do is to throw our energy into the operations and the building and the policy work that's required to move this work forward and not communicate about it effectively. And so within SafetyO, you know, you will see an action about implementing or developing a robust communication approach, you know, that helps advance the goals of SafetyO. And so we're working on that right now. And so I think part of it is that we need to communicate, because there's a lot happening when it comes to gun violence prevention in our city. And so gun violence is, you know, like I said, it's a big complex issue, but there is like the prevention elements of gun violence. There's the intervention or the interruption approaches to gun violence. There's the response and recovery to the crisis of gun violence. And then there's the social development or long-term development that needs to happen based on what you learn from each of those areas. So clearly that some of the folks that Louis talks with, and they want to see what's happening right now on the ground in my community. You know, that's where I can talk about the number of investments that the city has, you know, that our community crisis response program, the development and implementation of Towards Peace, Focus Toronto, which is a high-risk intervention model, our youth violence prevention work, where we have type workers, which provide employment. And parks, forestry, and recreation. I can go on and on and on about the investments that are there. And then I could talk about the provincial investments that are there and the gang prevention intervention work, youth outreach workers. And I can talk about all of these things and let people know what's happening in their community. And then we can have the conversation whether that's enough or not enough, or if those things are coordinated. The approach that we're working on right now is to really, I don't think we need more data. Like we have actions within SafeTO about data. We have actions within SafeTO about building a multi-sector collaborative advanced analytics lab. That's a part of our work. But the reason we're doing that is not to generate new data, because I don't think we need more data. The community has told us what's wrong. What we do need is insight. We need insight to sort of advance the revolution, of Louis March, but also of the city. We need to awaken people about the importance of prevention, the importance that young people and play in our city, and that we need to be building young leaders, and we need to be able to look at positive youth development as a form of gun violence prevention. We need to look at children and families, and we need to awaken people that when we're not investing in those spaces or creating the conditions for families to thrive, later on in life, we're going to be dealing with, the propensity for violence. And what we need to shift from is describing the problem, using our data for action, and mobilizing with community in real time. And so with SafeTO, within the first year, and this is what we're working on right now, is we're actually looking at, a number of things. So there is, the Toronto Community Crisis Service, which is providing a 24/7 alternative to police response to that community-led response to mental health calls for crisis service. And so we're operating that in four different areas. When it comes to gun violence, we are taking the existing work that's happening in the service system, and we're partnering with multiple different entities, including, Toronto Community Housing, Toronto Police Service, the school boards, the Ministry of Solicitor General, the Ministry of Attorney General, and the Ministry of Children and Community Social Services, to create an integrated Toronto office to prevent gun violence, so that if the province, for example, is investing, in gang prevention intervention work in the Northwest, and the police service is investing in, hashtag 416 Engage, amazing gang exit work, and we're investing in violence interruption work in the Northwest, that those things are actually aligned and the investments are complementary. And we're not actually just duplicating work. We're working towards a common goal. We're expanding our community crisis response program so that we can better support victims and bring culturally responsive, trauma-informed supports to communities that are impacted by violence. And again, I already spoke about it, but we're using an advanced analytics environment so that we can actually not generate more data, but generate more insight into the impact of the work that we're having. And that was very clear to us when we consulted community, that they wanted us to focus on these things. And so going back to your question, there's a number of things in place, and I could talk about each of them. But I think whenever I do that, community just wants to know when they're going, where we're going, and how they can continuously be involved. And that we're at the place now where we can actually start legitimately bringing them in because of some of the backbone policy work that's happened.
That's amazing. And that's incredible to see that there are so many different initiatives trying now to talk to each other in a very coherent manner. I think from a government bureaucracy perspective, that's a win by any stretch. I think often too, people forget government is made up of people. Great government programs with the best intentions, we still fall into the trap. I say we, there still is a hiring process, and these issues are so complicated. Hiring for the right temperament to handle these situations and handle these issues is very challenging. How do we undertake a hiring process where we can identify that Scott is really good in community development and economic or community outreach, as an example? He's got great communication skills and he can do well in the interview, but putting him in front of a community that's been through trauma, that is affected by gun violence, to find those important nuggets of information is so critical, because we know if we do hire Scott, that's going to be his job. If someone aces an interview and is not good in the community setting, the amount of steps that can be undone by that one or group of individuals is huge to bureaucracy. How do we help that hiring process as well inside government?
Yeah, I mean, the only way to do it is to be real about what you need. And I mean, different levels of government have different levels of bureaucracy, right? It exists everywhere. Even community-based agencies and grassroots agencies have the same bureaucracy. It's just a matter of degree, you know? It's like from the grassroots to a regular agency or, you know, a nonprofit agency to, you know, then the city and then the province and the feds. And each level you go has another layer of rigor around bureaucracy. But you know, I think, you know, you nailed it when you said, you know, governments are, you know, the government employees are people, or people in the public service are people. And that's really what it is. And I think it goes back to just being real to what did community tell us that they needed? Because that's it, right? I mean, and beyond everything else, like, that's who we're ultimately serving. And for me, within the work that I do, and, you know, I have a whole background in on the ground, embedded in community work for a number of years, and coming at the system, when I came into the city system, I've worked as a hybrid between, you know, embedded, like, on the ground community frontline work to system work and policy work. And so I've kind of worked in all the different spaces. And so for me, it really, it's like, number one, what did community tell us that they need? And then two is, what are we trying to do, you know, for me as the city, and what is our partners telling us that we need to do? And then where does that come together? The most common thing is that, you know, if we're thinking about gun violence, communities are impacted by gun violence, and it's terrible. That in itself, I don't know your story, Chris, but if you've ever lost someone to gun violence, and having done this work a long time in my, you know, and my personal life and professional life, I have definitely lost people to gun violence, and it is terrible. It never goes away, and you carry that with you. And, you know, and anyone who works in the public service, you know, we, you know, I think that, you know, we carry that with us in this work. And so that's one element. The second element is, you know, as we're looking about hiring who's required, we really need to look at, what does the job demand? And so, you know, we talk about lived experience, and that's really important. And it's funny, because I go to lots of meetings where, you know, people don't know your background. And so they, you know, I listen, my job is to listen. So I listen and take back things that they say, but people naturally discount others' lived experience. It happens all the time. It happens in community, it happens in the system. I think we need to work with folks from lived experience, from a number of different vantage points. So we need to work with people who understand the issue. And so from a gun violence perspective, that's like working with people who have lived experience with the exposure to or involvement in violence, and to name it, and lived experience with anti-Black racism and the impact of trauma. You need someone who can understand all of those spaces. And the job's going to require that. But at the same time, if you're going to move an issue like gun violence, part of the job requires that. A whole other part of that job requires you to be able to move policy and to to be able to navigate complex systems that are often at odds with one another. And you need to be able to find someone, you know, another job in the mix from, you know, being able to identify with community is being able to understand the system and understand how these systems can come together, to have the will to bring people together, to have the respect at the community level that you're going to represent their needs to bring people together, and then to have the backbone, you know, to not accept no as the answer. and so going back to your question about hiring processes, you need to be able to find the combination of the right group of people who can navigate the various different things that you need to do. And then you need to be able to educate community about why these folks are in the roles that they're in and what their jobs are. Because, you know, as soon as you say you're working on gun violence, people expect everything because it's a complex issue, right? And so we need to be able to like parse it out, but and then communicate with community about why people are in roles, what they're supposed to be doing, and what the work is. And everybody will have a different vantage point about what the work is because it's quite complex. Most people want to do what touches them. Other people like don't understand the negotiation, the policy development, the, you know, navigating the conflicts in mandates, you know, negotiating investment that is also required to enable the person who's front facing on the ground to have the best impact with communities. And then we all in the mix need to be able to empower the grassroots and find and build and trust and partner with local leaders and build their capacity to do what they do best in their communities.
We don't talk about that enough inside and outside government about, at the end of the day, this is an institution built up of people, and we are trying our best to hire the right person for the right job. On that point of involving the community, do you see a role, and forgive me if this is already happening, for the City of Toronto to employ community members to help with this important work? Because in many ways, those affected by gun violence, those that are helping the community may be best equipped to translate City of Toronto initiatives to communities or vice versa, and really can build those connections perhaps better than someone who did not grow up or is directly impacted by the issues inside the community.
In many cases, we already do in some levels, and in other cases, we need to do way more of it. So if you look at a number of different city initiatives, let's take the pandemic, actually. That's a great example. And so the vaccine task force. Here's this new thing that no one knows anything about that, again, is disproportionately impacting communities that experience poverty and have low health outcomes already and are also have limited trust in government to advance, advance our efforts in these areas. And so naturally, the whole system revved up to, you know, support, let's collaborate, let's do this, we'll try to cut down this, let's do this, which is great. But the game changer in terms of like trust around vaccines, having people from the community empower each other, was through a couple of initiatives. And so, you know, first of all, you had the Black Scientist Task Force, who was working with Black community in Toronto, who, you know, were scientists from the community having discussions about access, equity, impact, and human rights. And although it was about the vaccines, they also talked about access to education and a number of factors that we needed to consider in addition to the vaccine. And, you know, then you had the community collaboration structure, which was, you know, a number of, you know, sort of geographic based and issue based tables of agencies coming together to triage problems. And so, you know, we had a number of tables that were neighborhood, but we also had a Black resilience cluster and an Indigenous cluster that prioritized issues specific to their communities that were enabled to do that. But then most importantly, we had the community ambassador program, and they were vaccine engagement teams that were people with lived experience in the communities that went out and engaged other peoples to help spread the word about the vaccine, the opportunities to get your vaccine, and to program and animate spaces for people to come together to get the vaccine in a safe way around the pandemic. And so, you know, that's an example about how that happens. And so if you go back to gun violence, you know, currently, you know, we have mechanisms where people volunteer on safety committees and stuff like that. But to your point around employment, this happens in different ways. Sometimes it may happen through a community investment. So we have a youth violence prevention grant at the city. That youth violence prevention grant funds a grassroots agency or organization to be able to run youth violence prevention programming and work with young people to do that. And so that's a way where that can happen. We have the implementation of Towards Peace. And if you don't know what Towards Peace is, it's basically a sort of, you know, a multi-sector risk-driven approach to gun violence reduction. And we're working with local grassroots agencies and organizations who are bringing on folks with lived experience into their organizations. And those individuals will be violence disruption workers who are from the communities, who have an understanding of violence and have the local respect or credibility to be able to de-escalate tensions at the local level. And so that's an example of how that can happen. When it comes to SafeTO, we also have the Community Healing Project. I'll give that as an example here as well, where we are training young people across the city in specific neighborhoods to be community healers and to use trauma-informed, culturally responsive engagement as a means of violence reduction. And that group is training young people, and then that cohort that comes up become peers, and they actually use that as a means for economic development and do trainings for corporations and stuff like that. And so those are ways that that's happening already. And so within SafeTO, right from the onset, what we have is the ability to do that with the Toronto Office to Prevent Gun Violence. And so as we attempt to build this place where all the systems can come together, we have created investment for community leadership within the actual office itself, so that community can be part of the design and the implementation of the actual office in itself. And then secondary to that, we've created investment to have a couple of lived experience advisory committees. And so one is to have a lived experience advisory committee of the Toronto Office to Prevent Gun Violence that reflects the communities that are most impacted by violence and reflects the diversity between across young people and families that'll help us design something that's responsive to community. And so we will actually want to embed this, you know, to have embedded community staff and in a specific advisory that would be paid for their time to be involved in the creation of the office. And that's how we're attempting to do it. We're also looking at the development of a version of that around our policy work. And so as we continue to build out our data work, you know, and I'm very clear again, we don't need more data, we need more insight. And so as part of that data work, as we move forward in the work that we're doing, we're trying to bring on cohorts of, you know, people with lived experience of violence, as I said earlier, to help us actually understand and action the data and the insights that we're gaining from the data. And maybe even, you know, have a policy cohort of young people, you know, so then we have an operational component of young people in the Office to Prevent Gun Violence. And then we have another policy contingent in the data work that we're doing that, you know, that help us make sure that we're being authentic in the work that we're doing. So that's a couple of examples about how we're doing that. In terms of the last part, how can we do that better? I just think that as we develop new programs, you know, and like when SafeTO was developed, we developed guiding principles that enabled us to reflect what community told us. And there's six guiding principles, and I won't go through all of them, but one of them is to do no harm. One of them is to be responsive and evolve with the changing needs of community. In order for us to do that, we need people from the community to help us drive what that direction is and help us, you know, or hold us to account for what we say we're going to do versus what we actually do.
A follow-up to that would be sustained engagement. So it's one of those things that I always wonder about myself. Just doing this podcast as well, the ability to cover these big topics has been really fascinating. But one thing I've noticed is that community members concern themselves about gun violence, but continuing to work in that space can be very mentally taxing. Continuing to work with the city can be mentally taxing. Reliving these traumatic experiences can be mentally taxing. And so getting away from the topic sometimes is healthy and good for someone. But yet on these very challenging topics, we do need sustained engagement. And I'm sure the city has struggled perhaps with this as well. How do we continue to make sure that there's uptake, that people are engaged, that there's a commitment to a long-term vision, that people see that vision and they believe in it? Can you tell me a little bit more about how the city's trying to kind of foster that as well, in addition to all the great initiatives they're doing at the ground and the grassroots level?
Part of it's about storytelling again, and really, like, you know, sharing what's happening. Sometimes we're busy doing the work, and we could do it better. And so there's a number of ways from in community experience. We our community crisis response program at the city has safety committees already that exist, that consist of residents, service providers, you know, city staff, police services, and they, you know, that's an ongoing form of engagement in this work. We can actually do a better job at that, and we need to continuously work at that. But we have these safety committees. There's over 24 of them across the city that already exist. And then there's other city engagement bodies. So, like, for example, every community center has an advisory committee. The libraries have, you know, an engagement platform. The Toronto Police Service has community police liaison, so on and so forth. Also, within SafeTO, we've created advisories for some of the specific actions, but also for the strategy as a whole. So, for example, the Toronto Community Crisis Service has an accountability circle and an accountability table. Help design the actual intervention is now helping the accountability around that intervention. The Confronting Anti-Black Racism at the city has a number of different circles, but they have a partnership advisory circle where it's elders from the Black community and leaders within the Black community that report. It's actually connected to council through one of the committees, and they help review the actions within that particular strategy. And so there's a number of mechanisms. Yeah, there's another mechanisms there. So there's another one for the 2S LGBTQ plus population, and they have an advisory table, and there's several advisory tables, right? The school boards, you know, that's not a city function, but they have parent advisory committees, you know, and then, you know, through SafeTO, we're trying to create this governance. So we're building out what the SafeTO advisory committee could be. We add an advisory through the design. Now we're moving into implementation, we're taking a look at that, and we'll be bringing that together. And so the challenge becomes, there's actually a lot of ways to become involved in Toronto, you know, whether it's through the school board, the city. Toronto Community Housing has tenant elections. Like, they have like tenant leaders, they have resident committees. And so there's a number of ways to get involved. So the other part of the challenge is, actually, how do we actually put information so people know what exactly is happening and how what they're doing connects to the bigger vision? And I think that's where we get lost here, is there's a lot of great things happening at the local level, but people don't understand that they're actually part of a broader movement of people across the city. So, like, we've done things in the past where we've brought, you know, we've had sort of conferences and things like that. And we actually just need to do more of that and work with residents and local leaders to plan those out.
I know in 2021, there were approximately 209 persons killed or injured as a result of firearm discharges in the city of Toronto. Relatively speaking, across North American major cities, that's low, but that does not mean that Toronto by any means is not affected by gun violence in specific neighborhoods. Since 2004, it's been on a trend upward, but the areas with most activity are York University Heights, Glenfield, Jane Heights, Malvern, Kensington, Chinatown. Can you tell me how they are being coalesced to these specific areas within the city where we see gun violence in a much more, I hate to say prevalent, but a much more higher level than other areas?
When you want to focus on prevention, the crisis can take you away. You know, the loss that experiences, the community experiences, can really set back prevention-based efforts. So we really think about how does the response become part of the prevention approach as well. And so what I would say is in the response and recovery stages of incidents, we can start there and work our way back to the most important part, which is prevention. You know, we're looking at not only to make sure that people have access to supports, but we're also looking about building trust with community and building trust with people and grieving with them and trying to create the opportunity for communities to heal with one another following, you know, the tragedy of gun violence. And that in itself can take you off track, you know, from the prevention based stuff. But, you know, some wise people in the sector is just this have always told me, and I really rest with me, is listen to community. They'll tell you what they want, you know, and on the most basic level. And so if you've been in a community after violence has occurred, you know, you'll hear about everything. You know, you're not just hearing about the loss, you're hearing about the traffic lights that have been broken or the camera that's been broken or the fact that the garbage is all over, you know, the place behind a building or whatever it could be, or the fact that we had this program and it was really good, but the people running it, you know, they moved on or whatever it is. You're going to hear about these things. And so it becomes about, you know, how do the different kind of work filter each other? And so the reason I started with the response is not where I want a response, but it's like one of the times where people are going to be the most raw with you and there's the most urgency is because something happened. And so what we've never done historically as a system, and this isn't just the city, it's collectively, is to take what we learn in those moments and apply it to how we prevent things in the first place. With the work that we're doing with SafeTO, we're really trying to get that happening. And, you know, and one of the things that we heard about was, you know, people aren't coordinated. You know, all these systems are here, but to the average resident, they don't care if it's the province of Ontario or the city. It's just like, you know, it's their tax dollars at work. And, you know, people get the distinction between, you know, education and city sometimes, but it, you know, most of the times, like people don't care about the difference between the province or the city. It's just like they need support. They don't care who's providing it. And, you know, and but people want our systems to work together. And so with SafeTO, we're on the track to creating this vision of having this integrated office that can do a number. To get there, we started working with some of the system partners to look at integrated safety coordination teams at the local level and, or, you know, and really looking at, you know, what does it mean to share information about the impact on the community? What's the nuance around that? So you're honoring the community and looking out for the best interests of community and doing no harm, but mobilizing the most appropriate service, you know? What does it mean to be able to identify a risk and to mobilize around that with the most appropriate response? Understanding that response may not be policing. It may be at times, but it may be, you know, an increase in hall monitors in the school. It may be, you know, providing access to a gym for a parent group to run a meeting. It may be, you know, it may be, you know, that we need people with lived experience out de-escalating things in the community. And so what we're trying to do is test run some information sharing and some joint planning with, you know, around specific communities. And we've identified 28 neighborhoods in the city. I think you gave a couple of examples off top that we have built six teams around that service those neighborhoods. And they're working with local practitioners and communities in there. And we're starting that as a starting. But where we're going is actually, so the collaboration is just everyone's business. And so I think we need people who are laser focused on the spectrum of gun violence prevention, gun violence intervention or interruption, and gun violence response and recovery. And that work is just inherently connected, given the impacts on one another. The second thing I'll say is that youth, you know, the prevention of violence, you know, is a real importance of the city. And so, you know, the city had already launched youth violence prevention grants. And there's been some amazing work that's happening, over $2 million of investments going out to a number of agencies across the city, and to be responsive to youth violence, but also to drive, you know, better outcomes for young people in the city. And so as we move forward and we're moving this direction of SafeTO, we have this great investment. And now we take the moment to align the investment with the strategy, which the strategy reflects the needs of community. And so we're looking at how do we do that and as a model so our provincial partners and other investment partners can do the same. And then most importantly, we want to be able to empower, you know, locally led and locally driven investment opportunities, or locally driven, like, you know, violence reduction opportunities. And to do that, we need to be able to strategically invest in there. And so who are the individuals that are leading very important, like, violence reduction work? Who's working with, like, people who are, you know, either impacted by violence, on the periphery of violence, or have the propensity to commit violence? People who are actually involved in the violence, or people who are, you know, who have been severely impacted? And so that spectrum of people, and who are the individuals that can work with young people that are involved with violence? Who are the people that can support families? And really, how do we actually prioritize, given that there's not an endless stream of, you know, investment, how do we actually prioritize programs and services will have the most impact on violence reduction at the local level? And, you know, in order to do that, we need to be able to understand the needs. So we need to consistently work with communities. And then we need to be able to use our investments to invest in culturally responsive approaches and trauma-informed approaches. And so I think that's the trajectory we're on. And then the last part I would say is that we really need to think about evidence. And so we've done a lot of work as a city and as a system. You know, in our city, community violence is considered a public health concern. As part of that, we have taken a public health approach to the development of SafeTO. And we're using evidence to drive our decision making, and we're using evidence and data to inform how we respond and how we mobilize. And we know that there are, as you've identified with your neighborhoods, that there's places in the city that greater need than others and are disproportionately impacted than others. And we need to be able to plan around those. We know that there are considerable challenges that contribute to why those neighborhoods are experiencing violence. And we know that there's tremendous assets in those communities that can play a significant role in reducing violence. And so using evidence to be able to drive how those decisions are made, how investments flow to those neighborhoods, and how do we partner with communities is just part of the approach that we're taking right now. And so if you kind of listen, I'll just sum it up here. It's like, from an intervention point of view, we need to be responsive if something happens, always. And we need to take what we learn from that to drive, you know, our ability to identify risks and threats of violence, so we can mobilize around those and try to prevent them pre-incident. And then more importantly, we need to look at, like, how we actually mobilize in the prevention space so that we're actually being more upstream and being more intentional with how we're mobilizing at the local level with the issue of, like, confronting or changing, you know, a concerning norm or normalization of violence in the city. And so that's kind of like the work that we're working on. And we're doing that at multiple levels. We're doing that with residents and the way that we engage them. And we're doing that the system of how we think about policy.
This is incredible to hear the city, what the city is doing, because it sounds like a multi-pronged approach involving multiple stakeholders, community partners, voices at the table. There's an accountability mechanism built in. There's sustained engagement. There's clearly political buy-in, as there are multiple levels of government working on this. The city was part or was at the recent march against gun violence a few weeks ago here in the city of Toronto. There's all this great work being done. I would ask the question about a couple things. One, helping community members buy into the vision long term. And I say that because last year when I chatted with Ricky Atkinson, we chatted about those that are affected by gun violence doing the work of community engagement as well. And those partnerships need to be built. But I understand as well, there's a deep mistrust and distrust of government as a whole, writ large, not just the city, but government writ large. What are some of the ways in which the city is attempting to broach that mistrust or distrust of government to say we're as invested in the long-term health of the community as you are, and we value your unique experiences to help us get there? How do you kind of broach that topic of trust with community members?
I think you do it with honesty and with courage and with transparency. And so sometimes it's good to bring other examples to answer a question. And so if you take the city's work, you know, in how we are now mobilizing, you know, our efforts to confront anti-Black racism. I worked at the city now for 12 years. I'm in temporary and kept building stuff and driving stuff here. And so, but I've been here for a while and I've got to see some things evolve. And I, you know, prior to the city, I worked embedded in communities. And so understand the issues. And when I first came to the city, you know, despite our efforts to improve diversity and, you know, the city's motto is that diversity is our strength, which it absolutely is. You know, in my earlier days, something like our efforts now to confront anti-Black racism were really that we should prioritize specific populations. That was like a line in the original Toronto Strong Neighborhood Strategy. And it spoke about prioritizing people from African origin and descent. And it was, you know, it was an effort there, but that enabled another step to happen. And then with the Black Lives Matter movement, that enabled another step to happen, and so on and so forth, to now has responded to communities who have identified anti-Black racism as an issue and that identify the fact that we need a dedicated approach. And the city of Toronto launched the very first confronting anti-Black racism office in North America, maybe even the world. Like, I don't know about the second part, but definitely in North America. And now, and has, you know, a whole dedicated team mobilizing a multi-year strategy solely on confronting anti-Black racism in our systems. Hasn't solved the issues of anti-Black racism, which are deeply seated in our work, but there's a significant dedicated and invested in effort to be able to mobilize that response. And when it comes to trust, that's how you build it, is you identify the issue and you build with community what the response is. The city just launched its Indigenous Affairs office, you know, with its first reconciliation action plan. It's another example of that. And SafeTO is another example of that, where people told us a direction. We, you know, the goals and strategies within SafeTO are huge, and we can't move them all at once. It's impossible, because we're trying to move these big, big issues. And so we just need to be able to be transparent about what we can do and build with community. For example, the Toronto Community Crisis Service, you know, it came out of advocacy around policing reform following the terrible incidents of George Floyd in the States, or Regis Korchinski Parkett here in Toronto, and other issues where, you know, there were mental health calls for service. Michael Elgin was another one. And, you know, these mental health calls for service that escalate into you know, into enforcement responses. And one way to look at that conversation is, you know, there is a problem. Another is that there's a gap, right? And that the police have become the de facto responders to the lack of a mental health system. So the city is investing in a policing reform function that looks at mental health. And in order to do that, my colleagues invested in consulting the right groups. They built an accountability table. They consulted multiple different organizations. We invested in organizations to do their own consultations, you know, and built out an accountability structure as we went along to then finally build out a service that could be responsive to the need. And then, you know, council invested in it and now it's being implemented. It's a long process, but community has been a part of it every step of the way. The SafeTO and the other strategies that you know, that's one of the many strategies. You know, so in this gun violence work, we did considerable consultations around gun violence and we've spoken to community and we have a lot of institutional knowledge based on our consistent and ongoing interaction with community. So as we move forward, you know, we're bringing that into the equation and we're going to keep creating new avenues for community to be involved. And that's the only way to build trust. Will there ever be, you know, total trust at every point? You know, think of your personal life. At any point, like one of these systems that's involved has burnt you. They burnt me. I know that. And I work for the company, but you know, I've been burnt by the city. I've been burnt by police services and have historic interaction with them in some cases. And I've been burnt by, you know, the education system and so on and so forth. And that's me. But when you're talking about like individuals in our community that don't have access or any engagement in systems that I would, that happens on a daily basis. And so we as public servants, we need to be able to understand that there is that mistrust. And instead of covering up, let's just be real about it and just break it open and have honest conversations about what we can do and what we can't do to be able to respond to the needs of community.
Well, Scott, I'm so glad that the city has folks like yourself with your experience working in, at the end of the day, you need leaders on the ground that can action this stuff up. Understand the system and how it works, work with communities. Those are skill sets that as much as we try, we can't really figure out fully in an interview process. And in this conversation, we've unpacked a lot of the challenges the city faces, a lot of the great work the city is doing, and also the challenges around making sure the vision and the mission of SafeTO moves forward regardless of who's in power and what happens in election in the election cycle. So for that, I'm very thankful because I think that adds that nuance to the conversation around gun violence in Toronto. And this can be applied in many different cities across North America. The need to engage as many people as possible and commit to a long-term vision with various factors feeding into that vision. I can't thank you enough for coming on and being part of this conversation. I think we've just scratched the surface on this issue. I'd love to have you back to talk more about these issues, and I'd love to learn more about the status of SafeTO as we move into the months ahead and years ahead. I'll leave links below to SafeTO and everything else for the City of Toronto that they're doing on gun violence. I'll also point to the various initiatives you mentioned. I'm probably going to email you afterwards asking for links to various things so that I can include those in the show notes. But again, thank you so much for coming on and shedding light a little bit on what the city is doing when it comes to gun violence.
You know, what I want to say is you probably heard throughout the interview multiple times I talked about, you know, that we need to be able to tell the story. And I don't know if you know this, but when I was creating SafeTO, I did reach out to people in the media actually as a group. So, you know, the same way I was, you know, consulting victims of violence and perpetrators of violence and people who engage, I actually reached out to the media about the media's role in creating community safety and well-being. And I think I caught them off guard because people were like, I'm really interested, but I don't know if I can because I have to be neutral and, you know, my role as a journalist. And, but I'm, you know, from my point of view, it's like you research this issue, you're on the ground talking to people and you write about this issue all the time. We need to actually, we need to build with you. And it's funny because, you know, I have respect for the media, and I used to be the co-owner of an online music magazine, or started in print and then evolved to online. And so I used to like employ journalists. And so I understand the integrity that comes with journalism. But I guess what I'm trying to say is like, I tried to reach out and engage folks as a stakeholder, not as a story. It's like, I'm not your story this time. I'm actually coming to you because I need advice from you about how to best engage, you know, you as a storyteller in what we're doing. And if there's an incident, I get the media request and I have the 50 questions that I got to try to answer in no time. But when I was proactive and I reached out, no one took me up on it. And, you know, for maybe because of journalistic integrity or whatever, I tried to understand, but the reality is, you know, I didn't want to miss the opportunity to come on your podcast and speak with you tonight because it's the area where we're the weak. We need the support to tell the story. You know, and one of my goals is I want to be able to find investment for local content development where we can employ some of the brilliant artists and, you know, communicators in our city to be able to help us tell that story. But the other thing is, if there's an incident, I get like 100 questions from every media outlet. But when there's a graduation, I don't get those questions and they're not there. You know, if there is a community event or like a celebration because, you know, 10 young people made it through a gang exit program or there's a young person from a community got a scholarship and, you know, you don't see, there's no one writing about those stories, but they all want to write about the story when someone's dead on the ground. Of course, it's terrible. But if you tell the other side of that story, there's a lot of amazing things happening in our neighborhoods. And as a city, I could tell you that all day, but you know, who's going to listen to a big dork from the city? We need cool people like yourself and others that are going to tell the story. And so that's why I didn't want to cancel on you tonight, because, you know, I'm grateful that you reached out, but I'm also like, I really want people to embrace the amazing stuff that's happening in our city as well. And to tell that story, because the only way that we can shift a potential culture around violence is by injecting a culture of brilliance like that's in our city. It's already there, but we don't tell that story. We're painting the picture of like these problem neighborhoods, you know, these young people who have access to guns and are in gangs or thugs or whatever the language is right now, where really we have an amazing city and we have some people that experience some challenges in our city and we can do better by them.